Hello everybody, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. My name is Lee Mottershead and this week I shall be guiding you through a programme in which we talk about a big week on the racing front in Dubai, a big week on the regulation front in Britain and Ireland, and more grim news, sadly, for British racing. Happy Easter to you, Jonathan Harding, to you, Scott Burton in Paris, bonjour.
Bonjour.
And very good news about Constitution Hill after some worrying news over the weekend. Constitution Hill is on his way back home to Seven Barrows. Jonathan, why was he away?
Yeah, so this was the news that broke, and Nicky Anderson can't seem to catch a break at the moment, but it was suspected colic, which is obviously hugely worrying. Went off to a veterinary hospital, managed to avoid needing major surgery. Henderson was saying that they weren't quite out the woods yesterday, but we've had a positive update today that he is at least on his way back to Seven Barrows. So hopefully everything's moving in the right direction there.
Yeah, let's hope it is. Looks now highly, highly unlikely that we'll see Constitution Hill again this season at Punchestown or anywhere else. But Scott, I guess this shows us in the great scheme of things, missing one race, wherever that race is supposed to take place, is largely irrelevant relative to the horse's well-being.
Completely. And I mean, it's just one of those seasons where almost nothing's gone right, even from something as banal as whether the weather would play ball before Christmas and whether they got a run into him before he went to Kenton. It's if he comes back next season, the season after, something like the horse that we knew, it'll be a kind of an amusing footnote. Obviously, there has to be some concern that, you know, as I say, he's run once this season, he's now had colic issues, that maybe we might get fewer glimpses of him in the future than we'd hope. But I think Nicky Henderson and Michael Buckley will just be hoping that it's just one of those years that you can just put a line through and they'll have a summer out of grass and then build him back up for the season to come, starting in kind of October, November time.
Yeah, absolutely. We send Constitution Hill and all those looking after him our very best wishes for a full recovery and a happy and healthy summer before next season. The flat season, the core flat season, is now already underway, and we had the latest big international stopping point on Saturday with the Dubai World Cup night at Maidan. And although Scott Burton is sat in his elegant Paris apartment, he was in Dubai last week, were you not, Scott?
I was. And what a meeting it is, it always has been, really, but just always reminds me what a kind of international crossing place it is. Not only so many great horses from around the world, and it is probably along with the Breeders' Cup the meeting where you get the best turf and the best dirt horses rather than one half or the other, really. A stellar lineup in terms of horses and horsemen and jockeys, but also in terms of administrators. And you know, as you say, we're just about to embark on the flat turf season here. Plenty of people will already be thinking about Royal Ascot, Goodwood, York, and then the big autumn meetings as well. And the number of people you meet both at morning track work and then on the race course itself on the Saturday, from, you know, Ed Arkell and was there from Goodwood, Nick Smith from Ascot, obviously, Anthea Moorshead representing York. And you look at the cast of horses that were running on that night, and it wouldn't be a surprise to me if some of the big international names that you saw there, one or two of them or one or two of their stablemates might be making their way to a race course much, much closer.
Scott, what would be the standout performances from your perspective, good and bad? Because we did see some stunning winning efforts at Maidan, but from one particularly celebrated horse, we saw another stinker.
Yeah, Augusto Rodin, he is now becoming a real kind of Jekyll and Hyde horse, isn't he? When he's good, he's excellent. I think Chris Cook summed it up very well yesterday. He was, it's a bit like, you know, when he's good, he's very, very good, and when he's bad, he's horrid. I was talking to Mark Bird, the IHRB handicapper, in the wake of the race, and he said he's just a horse that's very, very difficult to predict which side he's going to get out of bed. It was a very slowly run Shima Classic, which can happen, in fact happens more often than not, and you quite often get the sort of big headline Japanese horses come over. This year it was Liberty Island, and when they go no pace like that, their stamina doesn't really come into play. She actually did very well to finish third, but he just never got in the race. He didn't make a great start. I think he had two behind him down the back straight, but he was just, it wasn't like his poor performance in Ascot where he cut out very quickly. He just was just toddling along in second gear the whole time. It just never really picked up. So Aidan said it just never engaged. And I don't think, I think Ryan could tell quite early on that things weren't necessarily playing out for him. But as I say, it was a very, very slow pace for him to have to follow. And he didn't look off the bridle. He just looked like he was just doing a piece of exercise or something. I'm absolutely sure we will see much, much better for him at some stage this season. Whether it alters their thinking about, Aidan was quite adamant beforehand that he had quite a clear program for him. He was going to go to the Tattersalls Gold Cup. He was then going to go to the Prince of Wales at Royal Ascot. And then they were going to look at America for him, potentially on the dirt. Some or all of that may still happen, but they just obviously need to get him back running somewhere near his best, because he's the most exciting horse in training in Europe, but not if he runs like that.
Yeah, Scott, I'm going to come back to you for talk about some of the winners on Saturday. Jonathan, before we do that, just back to August Rodin. He's clearly brilliant when he's on song, but he's now putting stinkers in the Guineas, the King George and the Shima Classic. To what extent does that damage his reputation as a whole? Because at some point they're going to want to market this horse at stud, and there's many great things about him, but to what extent does his lack of consistency and his the constant risk that he will throw in a stinker, to what extent do you think that damages his reputation?
I think that it takes a little bit of the gloss off, is how I would look at it. I think if you look at his breeding, he's quite an important horse for Coolmore, and I also just think, given the form that he has in the book and the way he's won those races, you can't knock him for that. It's sort of put that to one side. I just think, yeah, the nature of those defeats is what worries me the most. You know, if he ran second in a King George, or if he ran second in Maidan, you think, okay, well, he's still retaining that sort of ability, and no one's doubting his ability, but it just seems to me quite odd. It's the way he seems to, it's either boom or bust with him. That would be my concern, but I think it doesn't take away from the fact that the form is there for all to see. He's still very talented, and looking at his breeding, he's seriously important to them.
And Scott, do you think, based on what we know about the horse now, is there any way that punters can try and predict whether it's going to be a boom or a bust day?
Well, one thing I would say about, if you look at Aidan's record actually at Maidan, outside of UAE Derby, which is the sort of the dirt race for the three-year-olds that tends to be a bit of a jumping off point for the Kentucky Derby, he's actually got a pretty ordinary record at Maidan. Obviously, there was plenty of years where Coolmore weren't engaging with the meeting at all. But I think St. Nicholas Abbey would be his best winner on turf there. He's had other good horses go to the Shima Classic and run okay, but, you know, finish sixth or seventh or whatever. So I think you've got to slightly put that in context, really. A lot of Aidan's older horses do take. Luxembourg was pretty ordinary his first time out last year, and then came out and won the Tattersalls Gold Cup. So I think you have to add that little caveat as well. I think off the plane has sometimes been a problem. He was absolutely brilliant in the Breeders' Cup, but he doesn't seem to be an enormous fan of air travel. Other than that, no, you've just got to be... He's always going to go off at a seriously cramped price, because we all know what he can do. So you just got to be... It requires a little bit of bravery, doesn't it, to take him on trust that he's going to get out of bed the right side. But as I say, I think I would slightly add that, you know, as much as they were saying good things about him during the week, Aidan's all do come on for a run. And I think possibly Ryan had that slightly in the back of his mind as well when he didn't persist with things once he was clearly in a not going day.
He certainly persisted on Tower of London, Scott, who was very impressive over 2 miles. Laurel River was stunning in the Dubai World Cup. Rebel Romance produced what looked like a big PB in the Shima Classic. Victory for France with Factor Cheval as well. What were your highlights from the day?
I was absolutely thrilled for Tiago Shea, who's been out in Dubai and has been multiple champion for since I think he first went out there in 2001, former champion apprentice in Ireland. I was in a reception after racing had finished, and he and his wife and his two children came in, and the reception he got from the people around the trainer, Bupat Simar, he's clearly incredibly popular in Dubai, and he's been phenomenally successful there without actually having any kind of ego or anything at all. He's just a nice guy who just goes about his business very well, a very effective jockey. And he pointed out after the World Cup that, you know, this horse had come from Judmont, come from Bob Baffert, but obviously had plenty of training issues. He'd been off for a long time. He rode him in the, because he rides a lot for Bupat, he rode him in the warm-up race. You look at the caliber of jockey that was at Maidan on Saturday. Sheen Murphy is a good example. He was there for one ride on Coltrane, and when and we might come on to this in a minute, Christophe Lemaire unfortunately was injured in a fall earlier on the undercard. Sheen came in for the ride on Demas Sotagaki in the World Cup. You have people of that caliber who are just sitting there, you know, waiting for the call up. It would have been very, very easy for the Abdullah family to say, well, Tiger's done a good job, but, you know, we can get anybody from Franca di Torri downwards, basically, to ride the horse. And they kept it, kept with him. He had a terrible draw in stall 12, and they knew he was going to roll forward. He rode him with confidence. He rode him like he was going to stay, even though two runs ago he was running over 6 furlongs. This is essentially a sprinter who stays. He's a bit of a freak from that point of view, and he just gave him a lovely confident ride, and the race was over turning in. So unfortunately we don't look like we're going to get to see the horse abroad. They don't seem to be particularly tempted by the Breeders' Cup, but that was a lights out performance. I thought also on the dirt, Forever Young, the Japanese horse that won the UAE Derby and is now going to go to the Kentucky Derby. We're obviously very familiar with the idea that the Japanese would love to win the Poodle Up the Triumph, but the Kentucky Derby is probably quite a close second now in terms of horses, that races they'd like to win. And he looks, in a year that my spies in America tell me there aren't, it's not a great crop of three-year-olds, it doesn't look like it at the moment. He goes there with a proper chance. He's ridden by a young jockey, 26-year-old, called Ryuki Sakai, who is very clearly the next big thing from Japan, and trained by Yoshita Yahagi, who, and it was an extraordinary moment, came into the press conference and announced through the interpreter that his father had died on Saturday morning in Japan, and he dedicated the victory to somebody he described as his mentor. So a very emotional victory there, but that horse goes to... he won in Saudi as well. That horse goes to Churchill Downs with a big chance. So they'd probably be the two going forward. It was great to see Rebel's Romance back to form. And obviously William Buick gave him a lovely, straightforward, no-nonsense ride. When you think that horse was sixth or seventh, I think, beaten 11 lengths by Equinox in the Shima Classic last year, that just goes to show you what a stellar racehorse he was. But good performance nonetheless, and we could be seeing him in plenty of big races. Quick update on two of the injury stories. Christophe Lemaire, as I say, unfortunately had a fall on catnip in the Dubai turf. He's fine. He's got a broken collarbone and one cracked rib, broken rib, but no lasting damage apart from that, and was smiling and talking to people in hospital on Saturday evening. That's good news. Eldar Eldarov was withdrawn by the starter before the Gold Cup. The horse next in the next stall kicked the stall, and it made Eldar Eldarov jump up, and he hit his head on the stalls. He was taken to the Dubai Equine Clinic straight after the race, and I spoke to Chris Wall, KHK's Bahraini owner's racing manager, this morning. And he's still there, still undergoing tests. It looks like it might be a bit more than a concussion, but he's happy and he's comfortable and he's eating, and he looks a lot brighter than he did on Saturday, and Sheikh Khaled is sparing no expense. He's flying his own specialist in from America to run some tests over Eldoran. So we, fingers crossed, may have some better news by the middle of the week.
Thanks, Scott. Very comprehensive recap then of what happened in Maidan. Just quickly before we move on, Jonathan, positive news then on Christophe Lemaire and Eldarov. Fantastic day for Tag O'Shea. That's, I think, a victory that Scott has said will have been welcomed in Dubai but elsewhere. So great for him. Disappointing, though, that a horse who wins the Dubai World Cup as stunningly as Laurel River did, in effect, will now disappear from the racing consciousness for the rest of the year.
Yeah, that is a little bit concerning. Not concerning might be the wrong word. A little bit disappointing because, you know, you win a race of that calibre, you want to see him rocking up at all the big dances globally. I mean, I was watching Maidan with a sort of British and Irish hat on, and of those performances, I mean, Factor Cheval has a really interesting European campaign mapped out quite comprehensively in the press conference, which is quite nice. Usually ask a trainer 2 minutes after they've won a race and they go, well, we'll get home and think about it. But he had a pretty clear idea of where this horse was going to go. It looks like Ascot, Sussex Stakes, bumped into Paddington last year, of course, and Big Rock on Champions Day. So I think he's going to be a big player in the British turf races. And also another name that almost last season we forgot about a little bit is Charlie Appleby. I mean,
yeah,
to have a big winner like that, it felt a lot like a statement of intent. And I know he spoke to our reporter Stuart Riley out there about how he didn't maybe have the horses last year and it's a bit of a rebuild, but if he's somewhere back to full strength, you can see him having a big part to play in the flat season. I think a normal service will resume with Appleby and Godolphin this year.
Yeah, they will certainly be hoping so, and there will no doubt be lots of interesting features and tipping pieces relating to the success or otherwise of the Godolphin string through 2024. And you can read those if you are a member of our Ultimate Members Club, and we have a fantastic offer relating to the club right now. Welcome back to the front page, and as promised at the top of the programme, we're now going to look at some disciplinary and regulatory issues that we reported on last week. The first relates to top Irish trainer Tony Martin, who last week was in the news because Irish Racing's appeals board ruled in favour of the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board, which had appealed the penalty given to Martin following the victory of First Man in a race at Dundalk last year, after which First Man tested positive for a local anaesthetic. Martin received a 6-month suspension that was suspended for 2 years. As a result of the appeals board's intervention, Martin will now serve a 3-month live suspension that will rule him out of racing through the summer this year and meetings, including the Galway Festival. And as was reported at the time of the initial suspension, initial penalty last year, that was Martin's third positive dope test in 4 years. In Britain, the dual Grand National winning jockey Derek Fox was in the news last week because on Tuesday he rode a horse of victory called Clovis Boy at Newcastle. It appeared that Fox had hit the horse 8 times in the closing stages of the race. That would have been one over the permitted level and would have triggered a 4-day suspension. The WIP review committee looked at that on Thursday. Had Fox received a 4-day ban, he would have been okay to ride Grand National favourite and reigning champion Corrett Rambler in the Grand National, because a 4-day ban can have days deferred. But there was also a suggestion that Derek Fox might have incurred further breaches. It turned out that the WIP review committee did indeed want to ask Derek Fox about a potential other breach, and in doing so, it asked him to provide further observations on that matter. Those observations he had 2 days to provide, and they won't be assessed now until the WIP review committee meets again on Tuesday, and as a result, no suspension can start until 2 weeks after that point, which means Derek Fox is free to ride Corrett Rambler in the Grand National, a massive relief to him, but also to trainer Lucinda Russell and the horse's owners. And finally, former British trainer Gary Sanderson has been disqualified for 2 years after an integrity case last week relating to a conviction that Gary Sanderson received last year over equine welfare breaches in relation to five horses, nine individual breaches. There was a fiery meeting last week. A BHA disciplinary panel met in relation to Gary Sanderson, in which, to say, he received a 2-year suspension, which he immediately vowed to appeal. Phew, Jonathan, a lot to get across there. You wrote about the Derek Fox situation.
Yes.
He was no doubt approaching that that meeting on Thursday with sweaty palms.
So there were reports that there could be this sort of secondary breach the day before. So we were all watching and waiting for those whip review panel findings to drop, which they did towards the end of the day, very helpfully. But yeah, it was a little bit of a nervous wait, I think, for Derek Fox. I'd imagine there might be people sort of having a look and thinking perhaps it feels a little bit convenient, but actually that is one of the protocols in the panel, that if another breach is under consideration, that riders quite understandably have the right to respond to something that they didn't have the opportunity to do so on race day. It's good news, and it's just a case of the BHA and its panel following its procedures.
Yeah, Scott, as Jonathan said, some might have thought it looked a bit like a fudge in allowing Derek Fox to maintain his association with Cot Rambler in the Grand National, but the whip review committee was only following the rules, guidelines, etc. before. I suppose what you can say is that among the changes to the whip rules in the last year or so, one of them has been that suspensions kick in after the whip review committee makes its decision, not as in the old days, any penalty will kick in 2 weeks after an offence. And in that sense, the changes to the rules have very much worked in Derek Fox's favour.
They have. In this case, obviously, you've got your sort of window of terror, if you like. You sometimes see jockeys taking fewer rides in the lead up to a big festival, either on the flat or on over jumps, where they're worried about an interference suspension or a whip problem ruling them out of the really, really big weeks. It obviously would have been very unfortunate for Derek, who is, let's face it, a bit of a modern master around Aintree. He's not only won the race twice, but he's demonstrably won the race from a jockey's point of view. Obviously, he was riding the right horse in One for Arthur and with Corrett Rambler. It's the horse that gets you there. But just in terms of his kind of judgment of pace around Aintree and his kind of strategic now, so there's very few people who can match him. So it would have obviously been a big shame for him not to be there. I think it probably demonstrates that the rules are working pretty well, doesn't it? I think that if there's something you can say across all three of these disciplinary cases, I think the regulator comes out of all three of them quite well, and they will be able to point to say we have this independent committee that reviews. They have ways of asking for extra information like this to take a little bit longer to come up with a decision. They've already obviously had from when the offence was committed round to the following Tuesday, but then if they needed a little bit more information, a little bit more time, they would say this is a demonstration of the rules working very, very well. And yes, there may be a few people saying, well, that's how convenient is that? But on the other hand, can you imagine if he'd been ruled out? I don't know what the extra technical infringements were, if he'd got extra days for those, and he was going to miss the Grand National, and Lucinda and Skew had to find another jockey for Corrick Rambler. I think that would have reignited a debate which has largely gone cold. I mean, it's not something we talk about very much. If you think about this show this time last year, when the rules were very much in their infancy, it was all anybody was talking about. And I think the biggest tribute you can pay to the way that they've been developed with further consultation with the PJA is that they are largely not very controversial now. And this is avoided by following the protocols to the letter. It's had the happy byproduct of avoiding potentially quite unwanted headline. So I think everybody comes out of it okay.
I think those are all really fair points, Scott, and Cheltenham Festival as well. Largely, that was a meeting at which, among the many talking points that we had there, the whip wasn't one of them. Jonathan, just moving on to the Tony Martin case, as I said, when we're talking about three cases together, that was the third occasion of a Tony Martin train winner failing a dope test in 4 years. I think when IHRB's chief executive, Darrow Loughlin, was speaking about the case late last year, he was very clearly implying a dissatisfaction with the initial punishment of a 6-month suspension suspended for 2 years. During a yard inspection of Tony Martin's yard in February last year, it was found, and just looking at the quote here, that his medicines register hadn't been updated since August 2022, and that a large number of veterinary medicinal products, including supplements, equine influenza vaccines, needles, syringes, and vacutainers for taking blood samples were identified, many of which did not have an accompanying prescription or label. I think when you had all that together, it would have been difficult, wouldn't it, for the regulator if Tony Martin had been, in effect, able to carry on training without any sort of active physical suspension?
I think you're right. I think given the facts of the case, and you know, treat each case as it comes, but the regulator has to send a message in those circumstances. It can't be seen to be lenient because the sport lives and dies really on its integrity. And, you know, you can get bogged down in technicalities, and of course people make mistakes, they're only human and all the rest of it. But this is a case of, there's been a couple of instances where this has happened. Clearly a message needed to be sent in order to get it back to where it needs to be in sort of from a regulatory standpoint, that yard. So, yeah, I think this suspension feels more fitting to me than the original one.
Yeah, and Scott, just briefly, the Gary Sarnason case, Pete Scargill's reporting from that one very clearly conveyed the somewhat chaotic nature of the case, with Mr. Sarnason seeking to challenge the guilty verdict that had been made against him in a York court last year over those equine animal welfare breaches. It's more important than anything else, really, isn't it, that where there are instances of equine welfare transgressions, that the sport has to send out the strongest possible message, so much so that some people might look at a 2-year disqualification and wonder if that's enough.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, it's hugely important. We have a very positive message to tell in horse racing about the way that our equine athletes are treated. But that only sticks with the public if, on the rare occasion, that people's treatment of the horses falls a long way below the required standard, that they are appropriately punished. And I think this demonstrates that. I obviously wasn't in either the York court where he was charged under the criminal code, or in fact in the hearing. As you say, Pete paints a very colourful picture of proceedings. I think Mr. Sanderson can be guaranteed that the disciplinary panel, the independent disciplinary panel, who heard his case before handing out that 2-year suspension, would be much, much more replete with expert opinion on correct procedures for handling animals than potentially people sitting in a courtroom outside of the sport. I think all three, you know, there are weeks when the regulator in Britain and Ireland, probably they get to the end of the week and people have got their heads in their hands and thought, how has this all gone so badly wrong on a disciplinary front? I think all three stories probably show the rules and the application of the appeals board in Ireland and the application of the independent disciplinary panel in Britain working pretty well. I would say that it's a good week to be a regulator from that point of view. We'll go on to find out whether it's a good week to be running the finances of racing shortly. But I think in all three cases, all three complex cases, the regulator has done well. I'm intrigued to see if the IHRB's challenge to the penalty given by the appeals board to Tony Martin emboldens both regulators to be a bit more proactive on that front. You quite often hear, I'm sure you speak to people, Lee, from inside the building on both sides of the Irish Sea, where there is some private discontent with some of the punishments handed out. And I think the ability for not only the due process to be observed by those people who are accused of wrongdoing is obviously observed, but also that the people who bring the cases have a chance to go back and say, actually, I don't think you got that right, have another go. So a good week all round for the regulators, I think.
Indeed. Thanks very much indeed for that, Scott. It could be a good week for you if you take advantage of our free bets offer. More on that here. Welcome back to the front page. Scott was talking earlier on about how we haven't been talking much in the last year or so about the whip since that all calmed down. One subject we have been talking a lot about, and for good reason, is how British racing is being impacted by affordability checks. And that leads me to you, Jonathan Harding.
Yes, so often the bearer of bad news.
Indeed.
Well, this is linked to a piece by our industry editor, Bill Barber, in Thursday's edition, sort of spelling out what can only be described as a very alarming drop in betting turnover on racing. I'll just consult my notes here so I get the figures right.
But yeah.
The Gambling Commission's figures showed that turnover in 2022-23, betting turnover on racing, was $9.12 billion, a fall of around $900 million on the previous 12 months, which is concerning enough in itself. The analysis by Bill and by the Racing Post showed that, taking into account inflation, that would actually represent something closer to a £1.75 billion drop on what would reasonably be expected if everything tallied with inflation. So it's hugely concerning. This obviously coincides with the preemptive implementation of affordability checks by bookmakers. It's of course difficult to say how much of that decrease in betting turnover is linked to that, but the consensus is that a large part of it must be, certainly anecdotally, and certainly the evidence suggests that it is, with punters being turned off, either stopping betting completely or moving towards the black market. An interesting little element to this is the fact that gross gambling yield, so the profit that bookmakers retain, actually remains stable. So that indicates that they are looking at their margins, adjusting them, and making sure that racing remains a profitable product for them. So in terms of sort of the money put back into the levy, it won't make a huge amount of difference. But long term, a decrease in betting turnover on the sport is hugely concerning for a number of reasons. For punters, it means bookmakers are less likely to view racing as an appealing and profitable product. If they do that, then you're going to see less bonuses, you're going to see less marketing and incentives for punters. And just long term for racing as well, this idea that it might be less appealing to bookmakers and people who like to bet on the sport, there's no other way to really wrap it up other than hugely worrying. You know, these are enormous figures that will have a knock-on effect for racing's funding in the long term.
Yeah, and even now, I guess, because although the levy return has been protected because bookmakers have reacted to the fall in turnover by changing their margins and by changing the offers put out to punters, in terms of media rights income,
yeah,
this will be knocking tens of millions of pounds of what the sport receives.
Yeah, and it just feels a little bit like death by a thousand cuts to an extent. It's just the case of, you know, it's such a delicate ecosystem, racing's funding, and that symbiotic relationship with the gambling industry. And it just shows that we have this regulatory situation now, and whether or not parliamentarians fully understand just how delicate that relationship is, when you start to fiddle around with regulation, the knock-on effect for British racing is huge, and the figures are there for all to see, aren't they? It's a case of, if people stop betting on racing, bookmakers will stop viewing it as something worth investing money in. And given the way that British racing is funded, wrongly or rightly, the horse has bolted on that one a little bit at this point. It could leave a black hole, really, in terms of the sport's funding. So, unfortunately, a negative story for you on this Bank Holiday Monday.
Yeah, negative, but massively significant. Scott, the numbers in Bill's coverage of that fall in betting turnover and what it probably means to British racing, again, it just underlines how absolutely essential it is that the government thinks again about the implementation of affordability checks.
It does. I think the timing of it, I think, a lot of the discourse over the last 18 months, certainly since the Gambling Review White Paper was published last April, from the Gambling Commission has been there's no demonstrable link between affordability checks, financial risk checks, however you like to phrase it, and a flight to the black market. I think when you have you look at numbers this stark, I think it's very, very hard for Andrew Rhodes to argue that what is already happening on the ground and even the threat of what will become more formalised once the consultations are over, if these checks come in. I think it's extremely hard for him to stand up with a straight face and argue now that it's not having a hugely damaging effect on the industry in terms of what it leads back to horse racing and in terms of the actual experience for people who are responsibly betting as well, who are now being, as you say, less margin from the bookmakers. I think if you look back a couple of weeks ago to the visit to Downing Street of, I think it was Joe Saumarez-Smith, John Gosden, Tom Goff, the bloodstock agent, and also Martin Krellis from Arena Racing, I think they went and spoke to senior officials there. Politicians and their advisors like hard data. They don't want to be taken with a vibe saying this is damaging horse racing. I think if you can put figures like that in front of any government of any persuasion, let's face it, there's a good chance that by the end of the year there may be a different administration in there. I think if you can demonstrably show that what is a very, very successful and very important industry is being adversely damaged, not just by the overall state of the economy, but by specific actions designed to tackle one very important problem, which is problem gambling, albeit quite a very small percentage of the number of people who bet on horse racing or any other sport or any kind of gambling activity. If you can say that the measures that are designed in that sense, along with, as you say, restrictions on the amount people can bet as well, placed by the companies who don't want to take a big risk. If you can show demonstrably to politicians and their advisors that you're damaging a British industry that is very, very successful, then I think you have a much stronger case.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And there is so much data making that point now that one would hope, Jonathan, it's hard for the government not to take notice. That said, we've seen in the past on this issue that no matter how much logic and good sense has been thrown at the government, they haven't really seemed to pick up on it. Just before we finish on this one, just make quick reference to the column piece I wrote this morning where I've spoken about an issue relating to Simon Double, who is the owner and racing manager of the racehorse ownership group Solario Racing. He's been involved in the sport for 30 years. And he contacted me to talk about how he banks with Santander, and he received an email from them alerting him to what they described as high gambling on his part, I think were the words, in recent times. He insisted that his gambling hadn't been significantly higher than it has been in the past, that he has a large turnover on gambling, but he's never, for example, had a four-figure bet in his life, so he's not a massive punter. But the point in general was that Simon was very aggrieved that his bank was alerting him to his spending on a legal pastime, and he questioned whether the bank would be doing the same for someone who was spending a lot at, say, Oddbins or who was spending a lot of money shopping, or who was spending a lot of money on the stock exchange. And it seemed to me and to him to reinforce that sense that among institutions, there is a growing tendency to portray gambling as a public health issue, which underlines for me the success of those who've been trying to do that, and the drip effect of negative coverage of gambling seems now to be influencing banks as well.
I think so, and that's definitely been the mood music for the last few years, hasn't it? This idea that it's almost become a public health argument. I think because the stories of people who have problems with gambling are they're emotive, aren't they? Generally speaking, they're a minority case, but they are easy to cover if you're a national newspaper. And nobody's disputing the fact that if you are showing a tendency towards problem gambling, that you need to be reached out to and receive the help that you need. But that is a very small percentage of the people who like to bet. And I don't think it's, for me, I just find it absolutely baffling that you would sort of entrust bookmakers or indeed a bank to be the one that intervenes and gets involved, or as sort of worthy of receiving personal financial information. It just seems that in this weird uncertainty, without any regulatory or a definitive regulation, everybody's sort of guessing at it. Everyone's sort of trying to feel what the right thing to do is and is guessing at what sort of intervention should look like. And in that environment, you're just getting, we see the knock-on effect financially for British racing, but for individuals as well, it's just completely haphazard, and I don't think it's doing anybody any good.
No, I'd agree. Would you agree, Scott?
Yeah, completely. Clarity is what everybody who follows this as a pastime, everybody in racing who would like to see the finances straightened out, everybody in the bookmaking industry who are trying to run a business and have no future idea of what the landscape will look like in 6 months, let alone 6 years, that's just bad for everybody. So I think the sooner that the Gambling Commission publish their consultation results, and that the government commits to listening again to these very legitimate concerns on behalf of horse racing in terms of its future finances. You look at France and Ireland, even in Europe and much further afield jurisdictions, going back to having been in Dubai at the weekend, Britain feels like a bit of a poor relation at the moment, and none of this is helping.
And just in terms of that consultation, I was on a panel last week at the No Now conference, at which the Gambling Commission's Tim Miller referenced the organisation's response or lack of response so far to the consultation. He said it would be coming soon, so we shall await that. You do not have to wait any longer, however, for news on the winning story in this week's show. As I always say in this chair, I don't like making my own story the winning story, because I have a huge guilt complex. And therefore, I think on this instance anyway, the regulatory discipline stories, although strong, they aren't strong enough to win the show, albeit they are very, very important. The news from Maidan, great days racing at Maidan on Saturday, and they will no doubt lead to many threads as the year goes on, particularly perhaps in relation to August Rodin. We wonder how many more great days and low days he'll have through 2024. But Jonathan Harding, your story about the fall in online betting turnover to an equivalent of £1.75 million. I think that has to be, given the current climate, the winning story. Congratulations.
I will await my cash prize. Thank you.
Yes, you may be waiting a while. But thank you to Jonathan. Thank you to Scott in Paris. A joy as ever to have you on the show, Scott. And I guess as the year goes on, if France has a similar 2024 to 2023 on the race courses of Europe and further afield, you're going to be on the show quite a lot.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Although it has to be said, by having me today, you don't have Maddie Playle. And anybody who listened to her on any platform, anything she wrote last week, will have known that she was all over California Spangle for Tony Cruz in the Alcor Sprint. So maybe you should be careful what you wish for, because you'll hear more informative information from her than you will from me.
Well, perhaps we can have a show soon where we have you, Maddie, and Jonathan on the show together. Ratings will soar. I hope you've enjoyed this edition. Enjoy the rest of Easter if you're watching us at a point when Easter is still a live thing. If not, have a great week. And Tom Kerr will be in this chair at this point next week. Until then, bye-bye.